In verse 1 it begins, it says, Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are called, who are the called, beloved in God the Father and kept for Jesus Christ. May mercy and peace and love be multiplied to you. Beloved, while I was making every effort to write you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you, appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all handed down to the saints. For certain persons have crept in unnoticed, those who were long beforehand marked out for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness. I've got to learn how to say this word. I've never been able to say it. And deny our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saving the people out of the land of Egypt, destroyed those who did not believe, and angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Yet in the same way, these men also, by dreaming, defiled the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these men revile the things which they do not understand, and the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals. By these things they are destroyed. Well, we want to look at verse 8 this evening. And coming out of this description of these three situations, events in the Old Testament that Jude has lined up to show that God indeed does judge, and he used a variety of situations, three situations. He talked about even the Israelites, those that he saved, those that he delivered, he ended up judging, and they didn't enter the promised land. And then, you know, he wasn't doing it in chronological order. And then he talked about the angels. And it seems most likely this would be a reference to Genesis 6, though that's definitely the one that's more interpretive of these three. And there the angels rebelled, not the original rebellion against God, but even in their fallen state they rebel, and they are put in judgment. There's a, you know, put in an immediate judgment awaiting the final judgment. And then Sodom and Gomorrah, where there was an immediate judgment that was where there are still results today of that judgment, and it's a picture of eternal fire. So there's a progression in the severity of the judgments. The first group, they were destroyed. That is, they physically died. Seems very reasonable of that group that physically died that some of those are, you know, in our terminologies, are believers. And then of the angels, they would put in prison to await their judgment. And then here, this city and area is destroyed, and it becomes a picture of eternal punishment. So a definite progression in the judgments seems to be the order that Jude put them in. Having given those, and in essence saying that, you know, people shouldn't think they're going to avoid God's judgment, then he says, yet in the same way. So in what in the same way? Well, it seems to be in the same way that these three events was, especially Sodom and Gomorrah, that'd be the most, the closest connection, but it seems to be that all of these, in the same way, they follow this same pattern of rejecting God's authority, because there's a disbelief in all of these, a rebellion, a rejection of God. In the same way, these men, so now we're back to these men, which is, you know, back to verse 4, for certain persons have crept in unnoticed, and the things they do, it says, you know, they're ungodly persons. They turn the grace of God into a moral cesspool, and they deny Christ as Lord. So these are the two things that they're doing. There's a denying of Christ as Lord, and there's a disregard, a total abandonment of any sense of moral restraint. And so, as we mentioned, the thing that's going on at this time is a form of Gnosticism, a form of knowledge, philosophy of knowledge, that separates the physical body from the spiritual person. So it's, you know, there, this philosophy that was at this time was basically said, I'm a spiritual being, so my relationship with God is not affected by what goes on physically. So I do not need to be concerned about any physical restraints, because that doesn't affect who I am spiritually. Now that's totally contrary to anything that's even remotely ever talked about biblically. But it was within the Greek culture, and we see it in the letter to the Corinthians, and it's here. And so, in the same way, these men, so that's who these men are, also by dreaming, defile the flesh, reject authority, and revile angelic majesties. So there's three things, three actions that they do. And those three actions are all connected to this idea of they're dreaming. So they're dreamers, and these dreamers are described in these three actions. but the very word dreaming, does somebody have something different in translation rather than dreaming?
Well, Holman says dreamers.
Okay, dreamers, which is probably better than saying also by dreaming, because that's a little more literal, literal translation. So dreamers would give you a different aspect. Because you hear somebody's a dreamer, you don't necessarily think they're asleep dreaming. Yeah, King James just it makes sure that we know this isn't a nice thing they're doing here. So they insert a word to make clear that we're not talking about. And they seem to pick up, the King James picks up on the word defile, and connect it with this dreaming. So that's really where they get it. But probably if we're going to pick a word and to be literal, to keep it very literal, it would be, what Wynn's translation that she has there, dreamers. In their dreaming, which is, you know, more literal, or by dreaming, also by dreaming. But the by dreaming here is not, it's not that, you know, they had dreams. It's not that these are visions. It's not, that's not what's in view here, that they had dreams and they got these visions, or even in that sense, it's that they're dreamers. And if you hear somebody's a dreamer, what do you think of? Okay, they're not grounded. Yeah, it has nothing to do with reality. You know, it's you can even use that. You know, you could be somebody that's even talking about the way things ought to be. Not necessarily dreaming of something that how they wished it was, but even the way it ought to be. If we do this, if we do that, But they're just dreaming. I was thinking of, I guess one you could put in this, loosely put in this category. On Sunday, I was telling somebody the other day, they were like, because I was telling them the only time I watched football over the weekend was when I was playing with my dog, and they were like, your dog likes to watch TV? And I was like, no. I'd turn on the game, the football, the only time I watch football, that's what I should have said. I'd turn on, while I'm playing with her, I'd turn on the TV because I could kind of keep up the game and play with her at the same time. But I just wasn't watching football over the weekend. But anyway, the Chicago, who was it? New York and Chicago, was that Sunday night? is right before half, and they're describing it and said the quarterback's been sacked, I think it was like 8 times, knocked down 8 times, and Chicago has the ball. That, you know, New York punted. They had the ball on like the 2-yard line, and they actually made a first down. There's like 30 seconds left in half, so that, you know, you don't have to punt, and you could go in, and they're only like 4 points behind or something, and this coach calls a pass play. I mean, he's been knocked down 8 times, sacked 8 times. That sounds like somebody that's dreaming, you know? He's a dreamer. He's saying, this is what we ought to be able to do. Yeah, but what have you actually been able to do? And the quarterback sustained a concussion on that play. He got sacked and didn't come out the second half. So that's kind of this not living in a real world. I mean, I'm not connected to reality. And that's kind of what the idea of dreaming here is. It's,
I'm sorry. There's a little bit of a connotation there, you know, somebody who fantasizes about things they probably ought not to. You know, modern equivalent would be like, you know, day trading or porn.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, and that's where, and maybe, and I think the King James, the filthy dreaming, I don't know, you know, if that would be understood to be kind of including that, or if it's just, you know, being sure that the character is understood. And I don't know that that's outside of it, especially with the sense of dreamers, but I think primarily what's, you know, in view here is this subjective dream world as opposed to the reality and, you know, of God's objective word and being blind to the truth, which would definitely open up and include that, especially as they move into the moral untruth. So instead of being insightful, they're basically out of touch with reality. So here you have people that are false teachers, and they're coming in, and here's the insights into the world. But they really don't have insights. They're not in touch with reality. And, you know, and those kinds of people are not necessarily, you know, unsuccessful. Because there are a lot of people that are, that, you know, like to buy into stuff like that. So
King James says, in like manner,
right. And so you have that with, and I think this dreaming goes with all three of those, and we'll, and there possibly, and there is a, you know, kind of an interesting one as we look at these three actions, that it, that there, these three actions may be reflective of the three events that we just looked at. And, but I think the dreaming, you know, is in that sense of out of touch, unrealistic, you know, their subjective world, and those. But as we look at these being connected, and there may be this connection, if you, as John brought up, in the like manner, in the same manner, the three primary words in the New American Standard are defile, reject, and revile. Well, if you think of the defile, you know, that would go very well with the Sodom and Gomorrah, how they polluted their own bodies. The reject, along the lines of their Israelites who rejected the authority of both Moses and Yahweh and even the report of, you know, Joshua and Caleb. And the revile, you know, along the lines of like the angels who abandoned their own home and they, you know, had no regard there. So there may be a connection in these three back to those three events. But the first thing that these dreamers are said to do are, you know, and I think that it's really these three statements, they're actually all verbal, so they're action statements that describe the nature of their conduct, of the conduct of the apostates. The first is these dreamers defile the flesh. You know, it's not just that they defile their own flesh, but they defile the flesh of others. So it's not, you know, when it says the flesh, they're not, it's not that they defile their own flesh, but they defile not only their own, but others' flesh. The root of the word translated defile, you know, has the literal meaning of to dye, to paint, to color, to stain. You know, it's to, you know, change the color of something. So this is that sense of, you know, is to be stained. So it's not a positive sense now, but it becomes this negative sense. And, you know, and its figurative meaning then is to taint, to defile, to pollute. It's used in Titus 1:15 and Hebrews 12:15, as it is here, looking at moral defilement. You know, basically what they have here is living without moral restraints, they're defiling their inner moral being. So they've put into this that there are no restraints, but what ends up is their moral being is in its very self is being defiled. Second, these dreamers reject authority. They reject authority. It says that they defile the flesh, reject authority. Well, the rejection here is, you know, showing their attitudes toward the spiritual authority. You know, and they reject it. The rejection, the word for rejection, you know, there's nothing really special here. It means basically to declare something invalid, to nullify it, to set it aside. And so when you reject something, you're just saying, I don't see it as valid. It has no meaning for me. But what they're rejecting here, it says authority, and the authority, it would seem here, is Christ's authority over them as Lord, and the authority of His Word. If you go back to verse 4, it's these people have crept in, they're ungodly persons who have no regard for the moral framework of God, and they deny Master, you know, our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. Well, that's what they're doing here. They reject the authority. And you know, if you go back to that story in of the Israelites, when the spies went out and they came back, you know, the ten say, oh, yeah, it's a great place, but there's giants over there. We can't go in. And Caleb is saying, no, you have to go in. If not, you know, we're rebelling against God. You know, you're rejecting God's authority. You're rejecting that God is sovereign. And so here, that's this, they're rejecting authority. It's a spiritual authority. So basically, you know, when they're talking about defile their flesh, they have no restraints, so their very moral being is corrupted. Now, they have no regard for authority. You know, who is the authority? You know, bottom line is these dreamers likely viewed themselves and only themselves as the authority to be recognized. So when people are above authority, when they become the authority, you know, then you do what you want. And when we see that in various ways, you know, at times, you know, always, you know, I mean, throughout history, you know, it can be in business, it can be in any kind of situation, but government, you know, life, when somebody decides they are above that authority, and there's no authority above them, then they end up doing as they please, and it usually causes great chaos to others and eventually to them. The third is these dreamers revile angelic majesties. I think in view here are the good angels, and the fact that these apostates rail you know, at God's glorious agents shows their utter contempt and daring. Now the word here, it's interesting. It's an interesting word. It's basically a word for glory. It's the, you know, angelic majesties. What do you have other translations? What does anybody say there about how it's translated?
I have a note that says glories.
You have a good note. Well, anyway, that's what the word means. It's not like there's two words, one meaning angels and one meaning majesty. It's just a word for glory. But it is used at, you know, in some reference. There are some places used when it's referring to, you know, like God's glorious beings. And so that seems to be the indication here by the next passage, you know, would help in that translation that, you know, it's the references to angels. But these seems to be good angels. And now, why are they blaspheming, which is what the word revile, actually the root word or the word translated that is to blaspheme, that's to defame or to damage the reputation of. Why are they making pronouncements against angels? Now that one I'm not sure of. You know, angels, you know, have, you know, a very positive role in terms of revealing, disclosing God's, you know, God's revelation. So that may be one role when you talk about, you know, angels as the those that conveyed, you know, God's word. Especially in the Old Testament, as you use the angel of the Lord, which is not necessarily angels, but a reference to the second person of the Trinity, you'd have that. So I'm not sure why angels would have been, you know, come up in this, but it's showing something of their attitude. They have no regard. They speak defiling things. They speak defaming things. They speak things that would hurt their reputation. They blaspheme against the angels. And so this is their character.
You know, we never, I don't think, really established what Jude was talking about in the previous verses about what was the nature of these angels that didn't keep their domain. You know, they reviled angelic majesties.
Right.
You know, or, you know, they reviled glories. You know, that could be part of the parallel
of what these guys are doing, yeah, along that line. And that would be in that scene that these three kind of match those three. Would be, you know, if you did that, it would be along that line that these are, you know, by reviling, it's not so much that they spoke out against angels as much as it's saying that they have something along the line of angels that do not honor the estates. Though,
it's pretty glorious what God has done to the new creation, you know, including the body of the new creation. Mm-hmm.
Though the next verse would seem to indicate that it actually is about their attitude toward angels, because it talks about, well, even Michael, you know, this very, very lofty angel, he wouldn't even do something as stupid as what these people are doing. So, you know, it's a little hard to know exactly how that looked. But to understand the essence of what's, you know, as with this verse, the next verse, the underlying essence of it, we don't really have to know exactly what it looked like and exactly why they were doing it to see that all of this points toward no respect for authority. You know, there is no authority except them. They are their authority. And when you really look at the way things are attacked, it is a destroying of authority. That's the only way you can attack things. You destroy authority. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily be in saying that you destroy that God is the authority. I mean, you can look at Jehovah's Witnesses. They say nothing negative about that God is the authority. They'd be positive about God being an authority. But they start to take other things, you know, what you cannot trust. You know, so you can't trust this, you can't trust that. And ultimately, the Watchtower magazine becomes the ultimate authority of how you understand things. But, you know, people, I mean, there's definitely a place for study. And I'm not, you know, when you start saying, well, words don't mean that, you know, we all need to study. But a lot of the apostate things, the false truths that come out, it's you know, you end up with some secretive understanding, you know, or you start saying, you know, there's, you know, like there's this giant conspiracy out there. Everybody's been conspiring to say this word means that, but it's obvious it doesn't. Here, let me tell you what it means. Well, you know, you're kind of like, well, where does this giant conspiracy come from? I mean, if it was only a group of evangelicals that said this is what the word means, maybe it is a conspiracy. But you end up with these, quote, word scholars that aren't evangelical Christians. They're word scholars, and they say that's what the word means. You know, but that's, so much of this comes off that. You have to create this authority to be able to be that type of a false teacher. And so you start seeing how, you know, it all goes around that authority. And when you see groups that break off and, you know, and have that growth and that, you know, there, it's all about it's something, someone has established themselves in such a way they are the authority. Now, you know, and in Christianity, I mean, you know, as we look at the Bible, there's clearly, you know, it's God is the authority. God's word is the authority. There's a place for, you know, biblically in the early church for leaders, the apostles, to have a role of authority. And then they, you know, the churches were established with elders. And so they were to have authority, but not in that sense of being the authority. I mean, you know, that's when you start looking at, you know, people like are in leadership position are never viewed as the authority. They're viewed as someone that exercises leadership, but that leadership is to be in, you know, not in a sense of dominating, but serving. It's very much a contrast. It doesn't fit that. So, but here what you see is not somebody that's come along to say, I'm here to serve, but someone that's rejecting everything else and establish themselves as the authority. And that's where apostates, you know, blossom. But we will pick up the kind of reply and the way that works in the next verses as it, you know, looks at the response with Michael. You know, Michael wouldn't even do something like that. But anyway, are there questions or thoughts or insights? Or Rob will be glad to answer them.
Well, I can tell you that all those hard words you stumbled over were translated differently in the Holman. So next week.
Good. I need to read out of yours, sir.
Yeah.
What does Holman say for licentiousness?
Promiscuity.
There you go.
And then you stumbled over subsequently to later.
There you go. I need to get a translation that has a lower reading level than New American Standard.
Specific
mm-hmm.
consciousness, which could be any kind of
thing. Yeah. And that's one of the trouble with our words, you know, like lust. Lust has very much a sexual connotation, and that's not really what it's. I mean, there's context that's clearly what it means, but it can be much broader in its concept, you know. And, you know, and you have some of those words like that. You know, in the Greek, actually, it's a neutral word. It's just the context determines whether it's bad or good, and you know, and we have words like that too. But some of those sometimes have a, you know, pick up a, very much like as you're saying, where it's only sexual kind of idea, and that's it's broader than that.
Yeah, I see why licentiousness.
And that's where these are coming from, yeah. And that's the idea there are no moral restraints. And which is just, you know, I mean, we can understand it from the standpoint of saying, I've decided to live outside of God's parameters. You know, we can understand what that means, and we can visualize that, and we can say, okay, I know people that have done that at times or whatever. But the concept that my spirituality is not affected by what I do physically is you can accept that that's a philosophy, but it's really hard to imagine it because it just seems so Probably in our society, though, we wouldn't have such a hard time if we thought about it. I mean, in terms of spirituality, not Christianity, but spirituality. That, you know, that's become the big thing, you know, that you can, you know, following the kind of the New Age movement, all of a sudden it became, I don't know when it was, 10, 15 years ago, it became very in vogue to say, I'm spiritual. And, people are, these very liberal people are being interviewed and they talk about their spirituality. And now, that's wonderful. Tell me about your spirituality. And as long as it doesn't get into, I mean, they can even talk about being at church. But as long as it doesn't get into Christ, beliefs, this kind of stuff, it's, spirituality, It really is intriguing. Somebody said the other day, was asking somebody on the radio, said, what do they mean? There's this, which station is it? I never can remember the stations, but it's the 1170, what's that, the KEF? Whatever it is, thank you. And anyways, there's that Pat Campbell show. He's on when I'm going to work, and he has some pretty interesting things. But I'm not sure what day it is. I think it's one day a week. It may be more than that. But there's a priest that's on, and it's a very, he's not a local priest, I don't think, though he may be. He seems to be a spokesman. Almost, if you, probably not the right words, almost a public relation priest for the church. He's very, very knowledgeable, but, maybe he is local, but I kind of have a view that he's called in and he's, because he talks about some other things, but he's very intellectual. But anyway, this Pat Campbell was asking him, they were talking about Facebook or something, and he was saying, well, what do these people mean when they say they're spiritual but not religious? And evidently that's the big thing he was saying, this Pat Campbell was talking about. That's all these people are putting down, I'm spiritual but not religious. And, that's kind of the end thing. So, I want to be spiritual, but I want to be associated with what anybody would think of religious, that I might have, I might try to impose anything on you, or that I might really have something that's exclusive, or that there might whatever I believe might have some binding aspect. No, I'm just spiritual. I'm in touch with my soul or whatever. I don't know.
The new one is religious but not spiritual.
Huh?
That's starting to show.
Oh, really? Now, what does that mean?
They have chosen to follow or practice a religion, for the psychological benefits or...
Okay.
Cultural community benefits, but don't really believe any of them.
Okay, so this could be coming out of a lot of health studies, that things that are going on right now. This idea that if you pray, if you this, so they're going to be religious, but we don't really believe there's anything behind any of this. But so interesting. So anyway, apostates are ample, not necessarily always. Inside the church nowadays, and it'd be an interesting thing. And I've never thought about this, and so I'm just asking a question. But if Paul was writing letters today, would there be a different approach to some of this? Would it be maybe not so much about in the church, but recognizing how many avenues information has of coming today? Now, there was other avenues then. I mean, because you had speakers and there was, all this. But I'm just saying there's so many more avenues and so many, quote, authorities. That would be an interesting one to see if... But anyway. All right. Well, do we have prayer requests?